Hello, mead friends. Welcome to the Regenerative Mead Podcast. I'm your host, Brando Tice, and today Frank and I sit down to discuss Frank's experience of tasting different kinds of honey throughout the world. We start off the conversation talking about the most wild honey he's tried, and then go into some of his favorite kinds of honey. We then get into some of the not-so-tasty honey he's tried, and then finish off the conversation with what honey he's looking forward to trying his mead in the future. Now let's get into it.
Hey everyone! Here at Golden Coast Mead, we consider drinking alcohol not only a luxury, but a celebration of life. If you partake in this celebration, we advocate for drinking regenerative mead made from real honey to help shift the $1.5 trillion alcohol industry in a better direction. When you drink our regenerative mead, you are helping to make the earth healthier, more biodiverse, and abundant. Drop monoculture-based booze and drink regenerative mead. Visit our website, www.goldencoastmead.com. to learn more about our regenerative mead business and be a part of the celebration. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks, Brando.
Thank you. What are you drinking?
Golden Coast Mead Sweet. It's back in our farmers markets, and I believe it will be online here shortly. Hopefully. If it's not already. Yeah. And it is. I mean, for me, this is like a very delicious introductory mead. There are sweet notes. There are rich notes. There are fermentation ale notes. But it all comes together into this like honey graham crackery ale-y drink with this incredibly delightful finish for me. Just makes me want to dance. Makes me imagine all those new mead drinkers trying mead for the first time and being like, wait, why haven't I tried this before?
Why haven't I tried mead like this?
Yes. You should drink mead like this more.
Excited for it to go to markets?
Yes. And for people that think that mead is a sideshow, you know, I think that this mead shows them, yes, it's made from honey. Like our dry stuff and our sour stuff, the honey is more of a backseat, and there's more of like a fermentation artistry aspect to the dry and the sour. Whereas with the sweet, it's like the honey is forefront, which is appropriate because we're going to talk about honey today.
That's very true.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about all your crazy adventures with honey.
I don't think they're too crazy, but I hope they're interesting. Okay. I haven't had anything super... Well, that's not true. There was the time that the guy from Japan brought the honey with the killer hornet venom in it, and I ate that, so we can talk about that. And that was about as crazy as it gets.
Okay, let's start with that story.
Well, you want to start with the craziest one? That's what... So, there's this guy in the mead world who has a meadery in Japan, and he's a super cool guy. He came out to California, and we've been talking about potentially working together and doing a project. Definitely a lot of aligned values and the opportunity for honey to transform, for mead to transform the honey industry right now in North America and a lot of places around the world. Honey's kind of a secondary aspect to a beekeeper's life. Their primary job is pollination services, right? Mm-hmm. Like 80% of a North American beekeeper's revenue comes from pollination, and 20% on average comes from honey. So honey is not the main effort, but if it were, that would mean the beekeepers were really optimizing their bees' health, because when the bees are healthy, then they're producing honey. Pollination is something they do by necessity. Mm-hmm. But when they're healthy and strong, then they're packing away honey in the hive, depending on their genetics. Sorry, a lot of caveats here, but life is complex. And if you don't give people caveats, then they don't have the accurate picture, and they go out there and then something different happens, and then you get blamed for it, and then they suffer, and we want to avoid all of that. So the caveats are that if it's a honey producing breed of bees and they're healthy, then they're gonna, and then there's nectar available, they're gonna produce a ton of extra honey. Mm-hmm. So what if the mead industry was fully developed and the beekeepers could just focus on selling honey to mead makers? So they didn't have to put their bees on the back of trucks and drive them around the country and make their living doing pollination services, which then exposes their bees to all the pesticides and monoculture and stress of migratory beekeeping that's causing colony collapse disorder, according to USDA. So
you're talking about that with this guy.
We were talking about that on a lot of different layers, and he was like, you know what? I want to come out and visit you. And have you heard of those killer hornets? I was like, you mean the ones that, like, if they get a foothold in a bee colony, they can, like, decimate it within something like 15 minutes or something. They can, like, destroy 60,000 bees if enough of them show up. But the Japanese bees have figured out that if they get the, like, scout wasp and they swarm it, and then they can't sting it to death because this thing is too gnarly, but they can make a ball. Have you heard this story?
No.
How the Japanese bees have figured out how to kill the murder hornets?
No.
It's incredible. They make a ball around the bee and around the hornet, and the ball is full of bees. So the bees form this ball around these hornets, and they're biting and stinging it. But the ones in the closest to the hornets start to vibrate and start to make a super high heat, like I think like 105 or 108 degrees Fahrenheit or something. And they're able to cook the hornet to death.
Really?
Yes. And if they do that quick enough, then the hornet can't go back to its nest and tell its other hornets to come and eat this hive with it. And so then they live. So this is a pretty gnarly story, right?
Jeez.
And there's this gnarly old Japanese beekeeper, apparently, who like cruises around his apiary with an electrified like badminton racket. Okay. And when he sees the murder hornets, he swats them with the electrified racket, which stuns them but doesn't kill them. And then he picks them up with some tongs because they're super gnarly. Apparently getting stung by these things is like one of the most painful stings in the world. And he drops it into a jar of honey. And so then as the hornet dies, it ejects all this venom from its stinger into the honey. And so he's like, you want to try some of this? I was like, well... Sure.
How do I not want to try some of this? Yeah.
And so, you know, mead tasting really tunes you in with your organoleptic capacities, aka like once you're an advanced mead taster, you can really sense things. And one of the things that I like to pay attention to is how a drink makes me feel or how a food makes me feel. And like just a little bit, if I take it and I sit with it, I can like feel the feeling in a very pronounced way. Someone would say I'm very sensitive. I like to say that I've just really tuned into what's in front of me, which I think anyone is capable of if they take some time and focus on it. You have experience in coffee tasting, so
yeah,
you know what this is like. Yeah,
you're just tuning into what you're experiencing.
Yeah, and like some people are like, coffee, oh, it's just brown water. It's warm. Great. And it's like,
it has caffeine, right?
If you slow down, like, well, what? Here, taste and smell this one and taste and smell this one and tell me what's different about them. Oh, this one's caramelly. This one's chocolatey. Right? Like,
yeah.
That's how it starts. So same with mead and same with honey. And so there's like the UC Davis honey flavor wheel, which we'll probably talk about in the course of this. And there's like sitting down with different honeys and really tasting them to see how they'd make into mead and then how they make you feel. And like typically honey gets you pretty excited. There's a lot of energy in honey, both from a calorie perspective, but also from a like, this is photosynthesis done by plants to create and store sugar and energy to entice the bees to help them in their reproduction. And then the bees go and concentrate that nectar into honey. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of like embodied energy in a little bit of honey, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, add to that this wasp venom. And I finally get to taste this stuff, and the dude has traveled across the world with it, and there is like a giant wasp that's like that big in this jar of honey. Like,
really?
Well,
jeez,
that big. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
For our listeners out there, it's like a
2-inch diameter circle,
extra large golf ball.
Yeah.
Well, if you can picture that, maybe like a playpen ball.
Like a nectarine or a tangerine.
Plum tangerine. Yeah.
Like there's a wasp that big in this jar of honey, and just smelling it, there's like this kind of pheromone, phenolic. It's not toxic, like chemical, like disgusting, but it's like when a bee stings you and you smell the smell that comes out of the bee venom, like that is what I'm picking up. And so I think I have like a teaspoon of it, and immediately there's a rush in my head. There's a sense of just euphoria, which is pretty wild.
and my tongue starts to tingle and then go numb. And I was like, okay, that's probably as much of that as I should have.
What did he say about it?
Like, he was like, yeah, it's intense. I mean, the guy sells everything that he makes, but there's only one person in the world that I know of that's making this.
But like, so he literally sells that in Japan
for like $80 a jar or something.
Jeez. Yeah. And he sells it with the wasp in it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. And apparently it's supposed to be good for you on some level. I don't know. But I do know that it was a unique experience and probably the craziest honey experience that I've had.
Do you feel like if you tried to do a mead with that, would that ferment out of it? Or do you think you don't know?
I mean, if you did a temp controlled fermentation and then, like, you know, the genetics of yeast change the precursors in the must. So I don't know what would persist and what would transform.
But that's still wild.
Super wild.
That's pretty cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's get into like some of your favorite honeys that you've tasted and stuff that, like, let's do your top three.
Well, most recently, oh man, top three, that's really hard. Could I do top five?
Sure.
And like go from like most recent to furthest past?
Yeah.
Okay, so I just got back from Scotland and Greece, and Scotland's heather honey is this like institution there, right? It's like heather is unique to the Scottish like peat mountainous highland ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And it produces this honey that's like citrusy and bright, but then rich and creamy and has a little bit of a medicinal character. But so you're getting like these three major aspects of like fruity citrusiness, and then this rich, creamy sweetness, and then the slight medicinal, like smoky wood fire peat kind of thing.
It's pleasant medicinal.
Really pleasant. Like,
it's not like
overdone eucalyptus or menthol kind of characteristic. Yeah. So Scottish heather honey and the ability that this honey has to transport you back to that place, I think, is really magical. So I loved that honey. And then we had Greek thyme honey.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is apparently a specialty of a few of the Greek islands. And when I tasted this honey, I was just bowled over by the complexity of it, but also the approachability of it.
Okay.
You know, sometimes those things are diametrically opposed.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing just had all of these like caramel, floral. I mean, to call it thyme, I think of thyme as a very green herb, mm-hmm. but this honey was just like the essential oils of it, which were like, it was like frankincense and camphor and myrrh. All boiled, like reduced down to really moderate but really nice levels of spicy aromatic incense,
wow.
almost notes, and then this sweet caramel body that tied it all together and made me go like, I want to make mead from this right now. So I like got the guy's contact info and was like, do you think it's possible to export this? And he was like, our production's super low. And I was like, yeah, but like if we paid you the right price, do you think it could work? And he was like, well, if you pay me the right price, yes.
Anything can work at the right price. So you've never had thyme mead.
Right. Thyme honey mead. Right. Like it's important to distinguish honey with thyme added.
Yeah.
Thyme versus honey. Like mead made from thyme honey.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Greek thyme.
Have you ever did you have heather mead in Scotland or not
The mead maker that we worked with said that he adds some Scottish honey to his meads, and some of his honeys do come from hives that are kept around heather ecosystems.
Gotcha. But you've never had like straight 100%.
Straight. Right.
Okay.
I've heard that it has existed at times in the past, and I believe Schramm's has experimented with a bit of it.
Okay.
So I think it's worth exploring further, and I think that could be a really cool line of meads to have, like, here's the honey of a certain place and ecosystem, and we can mm-hmm. talk about the stories of mead that come from these places through these meads and make it a visceral experience for people.
Yeah, I think that would be super awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so what's three?
Okay, so like those are my two newest ones. So then I'm gonna go to my like all-time favorite, and I wish it was more regenerative, but our California orange blossom, man.
Okay.
Like, if there, I grew up in Southern California, growing, smelling orange blossoms, you know, in the February, March time of year. And there were certain places, like out in Redlands, that were mm-hmm. still orange groves, and just north of the Tejon Pass,
okay.
as you go down the 5, mm-hmm. right? You're heading north on 5 freeway out of LA. You get through the Tejon Pass, which is kind of the mountainy area, and you drop down into the valley. And about 5 to 10 minutes after making the drop, there's this huge orange grove. And if you hit it at the right time of year, you can smell it from the freeway. But if you pull over and just like drive through those roads, mm-hmm. it's just this perfume of orange blossom bliss, of just like cotton candy and citrus candy and jasmine flowers, like all at once. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is heaven on earth.
Do you have a specific memory that it brings you back to?
I mean, I've grown up with orange blossoms since I was like 4 and 5 years old, like walking around our neighborhood where I grew up and like smelling them and being like, Mom, what is that smell? And her being like, come here. And then she would have me like put my nose in the orange blossom. And I was like, I could smell that from down the street. And she'd be like, yeah, isn't that amazing? And I was like, oh my gosh, yes, that is wonderful. And so, you know, every year that would then like double up, whether I was walking mm-hmm. with my mom or walking with my grandma or like, driving, you know, down the road and smelling it and being like, ah, yes. And now where I live, we have some citrus trees and they pop out every year. And it's just like, oh, like summer, winter is ending. Spring is on the way. This smell is that time. It's so
it's
good.
Kind of like familiarity for you. It brings you back to your childhood and the place you grew up.
That's an aspect of it, right? That it layers on. And then I can share it with my kids now and they mm-hmm. have that same amazing experience. But it's also just the fundamental pleasure of this aroma, which is just like all of these sweet and powdery and light and floral things in such a complex and balanced harmony.
Mm-hmm. So, and I know we've made mead with orange blossom.
Yeah.
Have we done it with local stuff or no, you've never done it with local stuff?
Well, yeah, I think the most local we got was from Palma Valley, which is here in San Diego County, okay. out like east, northeast county. It's hard to get it consistently. And the price point, I mean, I think now we're more able to afford the price point than we were earlier. But it's grown in a monoculture, you know? So we're trying to find an organic source, because we don't want to support monoculture agriculture if we don't have to.
Yeah. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's still like one of your favorite types of honey.
Organoleptically, and from that experience of like, hey, this is Southern California mm-hmm. in a bottle.
Yeah.
And this is an experience that I believe every human should have so that they understand that life can be this indescribably beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You can try to describe it, but you're still not going to, you're not going to touch what the actual experience is with words. Like it has to be smelled. It has to be tasted. And then hopefully people get to go to the orange trees and smell the orange flowers when they're blooming.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Okay. Yeah. So then what about those fourth and fifth ones?
Yeah. So I think clover blossom is my fourth.
Okay.
Because if I then take away the monoculture aspect and I go into, I mean, heather honey is basically the honey of a functional ecosystem. And as I understand it, thyme honey is too.
Okay.
Beekeepers have to be paying attention, but if they're doing their job, they're going to be able to collect those honeys from healthy, biodiverse, functioning ecosystems. Orange blossom, not the case, but potentially there are regenerative farmers who are doing the right thing. And then we can work with beekeepers who put their bees out at the right time when the flowers are blooming. And then we can get good honey from biodiverse farms.
Yeah.
That are practicing soil building, like permaculture based agricultural practices, regenerative agriculture. So then clover is a really cool story, but it also as a honey is incredibly flavorful, like white sweet clover. And there's apparently 4 kinds of clover, white clover, red clover, yellow clover, and sweet clover. And
And I haven't quite pinned down which is which, because I've heard some people call red clover sweet clover, but then I've heard people say that sweet clover is different than red clover, or like high plains clover. I'm not sure, but I know that there's a few kinds of clover. I think it's the red clover, but it might be the sweet clover that has this very characteristic cinnamon nutmeg flavor profile, which is really cool. And in the right mead, it can come across just beautifully. It's going to be more of a sweet kind of confectionery spice kind of recipe.
Like a holiday mead, Christmas mead almost.
I mean, I think it could, when you ferment it to dry, that cinnamon nutmeg aspect, at least with the yeast and fermentation profiles that we've been using, really takes a backseat. Gotcha. But maybe if you like got a Belgian strain and you figured out how to make that yeast happy with honey, which to our experience so far hasn't yielded, but we haven't done a ton of trials. We've just done a few and like been like, well, that's going to take some work. Let's use this ale yeast that's a workhorse, or this dry white wine yeast that accentuates fruit characters or whatever. But maybe one day we'll figure out a yeast that accentuates those spicy characters while still producing a dry beverage. And then we'll like pull off this like Belgian style of richness. Sorry, rabbit hole.
I asked the question.
So clover blossom, when you taste it, and I think it's red clover or high plains sweet clover, but that might be yellow clover. And yellow clover is more on the sweet side, not so much the spicy cinnamon nutmeg side.
Okay.
So the spicy cinnamon nutmeg one, when you taste it, I mean, the sweetness is there, and the sweetness is beautiful and bright and like very, if some honeys kind of have a like dark kind of sinuous is one word that Andrew uses on the team, but I'm thinking more of a almost terpenic. Terpenes are like this huge category of phenols, right? Yeah. And there's so many different kinds, but if you think of like biting into woody matter and that bitterness that happens on the back, like tannic, but it's not quite tannins. It's like turpentine, right? It's like that burny woodiness. Like sometimes honey can have that, right? And like this red sweet clover, if I have the name right, doesn't have that aspect at all. It's all this high flavor profile, like confectionery, bright sugar profile, and then these honey or these cinnamon nutmeg confectionery notes.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think there's a ton of opportunity, and then ecologically it's super cool because you don't need to tear up nature to make it. There's clover growing all over the Great Plains, and in fact it's a nitrogen fixing legume.
Oh, okay.
So it builds soil. So like the USDA pays farmers to plant it on marginal lands to build soil. And it's a great cover crop. So there's a lot of benefits to clover. And then if clover honey became sought after from a mead making perspective and the price raised above the like base bottom bulk prices, I could see beekeepers paying landowners for access to their clover fields to make clover honey that fetched these higher prices. And then that would incentivize more clover being planted throughout marginal areas across the country.
Yeah, that's super cool, actually. Yeah. There's a lot of potential for like regenerative growth there.
Exactly. So I think, you know, we've been focusing on organic honey and having a core lineup of meads. But I think that American clover and finding the right recipe for that could be a really great story and a great impact and a great product.
Yeah. Okay. That's super cool.
Thanks. Yeah. So that's 4 out of 5. Mm-hmm. And then number 5 is going to take me back to like the beginning of the professional mead journey when I was in the Navy and I was traveling. I mean, we were deployed. We were in the Persian Gulf. And on the way to the Persian Gulf, we stopped in Thailand. And I thought, what would be a cool thing to bring home from Thailand? How about some honey that's made here that's not made anywhere else? And there's this honey, or we're in Phuket near this wild part of Phuket, this like
I don't know if people know about Phuket out there, but it's a weird place, man. But we went into just like kind of a store, and they had honey on the shelf and longanberry fruit honey. And it was sweet and tart and almost had like a tamarind kind of spicy bite to it. But then it was like a lot sweeter than tamarind and a lot juicier and fruitier than tamarind, like a tamarind strawberry kind of cross. And so this thing was so flavorful and like so exotic, you know, relative to all the honeys that I'd grown up with, that I was like mind blown. There are types of honey in the world that I have never even comprehended, and they can deliver flavor experiences that I have never had before. And this is it. Like longanberry fruit honey is like I could, if I made a mead out of this that captured this flavor experience, I could pour it for people and it would be like taking them to Thailand on some level. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very inspiring and delicious experience.
Were you ever able to get that and ferment a batch with it, or it was just a one and done type thing?
Yeah, it was like this. It was like a sriracha bottle full of honey. And we carried it around for a few years, and then we finally ate it all. And then it's been gone for a good 12 years or something.
Do you feel like if you go back to Thailand, you could probably easily buy it?
I've heard other people be like, oh, yeah, longanberry honey. Like, that's a thing. You can get that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We also got a fair amount of African acacia honey, but I'm coming to learn that there are like 1,000 different kinds of acacia. So that's a very catch-all term.
Gotcha.
But I think the longanberry fruit honey is and I'm probably not saying it right. Like, what do the locals call it? If you know, let us know.
Please.
Yeah. But I think we should try that. And I think if we were to track it down, like, we need to have a honey importing company. But that's what Brian at World Honey Exchange is trying to do. So hopefully we can just work with Brian Warner at worldhoneyexchange.com.
Shout out to Brian Warner.
Yeah. So speaking of Thai honey.
Yeah.
No, you were going to ask me about my least favorite ones, I think.
I'm interested. You just named your top five. Do you have maybe your bottom five, bottom three?
I think I've got at least bottom two, and then we'll see what that stirs up. So Thai honey, you know, a lot of honey gets laundered, and China is infamous for putting honey into the world that is not good. Now, not to say that all Chinese honey is bad, but they have a reputation for putting bees in warehouses, feeding them corn syrup, and then taking what comes out of that and selling it as honey.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, not awesome.
Huh.
So
why couldn't they take them into a warehouse with flowers?
Well, you'd have to grow the flowers. That costs a lot more money. Okay. You could just buy corn syrup and then, okay, you know, subsidize corn syrup. Anyways, so we were buying honey from a group, and when we first got it from them, it was this blend of American honey that was incredible. Okay. And we were like stoked. We were like, oh my gosh, this is perfect, and our meads were turning out awesome. And we started to increase production and increase our order volumes. But they only graded it by color. And they shipped us a batch that was the same color as the stuff that we were buying.
Mm-hmm.
But when we opened it, we were like, oh my God, what is this? This smells like creosote. You know, like it's nominally the same color, though it's relatively darker. And it just had this aroma to it, and then we taste it and we're like, oh God. And we like look at the drum and it's like Thai honey or product of Thailand, and we're like, dude, we call up the seller of this honey, we're like, we were getting American honey that you were blending for us, what happened? And they're like, oh, that's too much work, we thought you'd like this instead. I was like, well, can you take it back? And they're like, well, you opened it, right? And we're like, well, yeah, we did, we had to taste it. And they were like, yeah, we can't take it back. And so it's just like, oh, dude.
It's kind of messed up.
Super messed up, man. So we kind of tried to work through it with them, but then it got more difficult to work with them. So we just ended up going somewhere else.
So what did you end up doing with that honey?
We made a sour out of it. that we called the Speakeasy Sour, because we ended up oaking it on French oak, and it like became this really dark, sour, almost like a light whiskey, you know, like a bathtub whiskey. And people liked it, but it wasn't aligned with our values at all, so we discontinued it.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Thai honey of questionable origin was one of my least favorites. It wasn't the longanberry fruit, that's for sure. And then
good and bad from there.
Yeah. And then one time I had this like burning honey. It tasted burning? Like burning. Yeah, it tastes like battery acid.
What?
Yeah.
Just straight, like the honey straight tasted like battery acid.
Yeah, like you dip it with your finger, you dip your finger in it, you put it in your mouth, and like the initial feeling is like when you put a 9-volt battery on your tongue, you know, it's like, ah! And and you try to spit it out, and then you can spit most of it out, but it's on your tongue at this point. And then this just bitterness just kind of like unfurled that's stuck on your tongue for like 10 minutes, you know?
Yuck.
Yeah. What was the deal with that? You could smell it first, you know? Our nose is a very powerful risk detecting device, and it smelled like burning.
Do you know where it was from?
This smells like burning. Gosh. No, because like sometimes people just drop off honey with us and they're just like, try my honey. And then we try it and we're like, oh, God. And then like we don't follow up with them, which is probably not the kindest thing to do. I fear constructive criticism. No, I used to fear constructive criticism. Now I recognize it as a huge gift, especially when someone really takes the time to deliver it thoughtfully and constructively. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that I probably could have taken some time to deliver some constructive criticism to that kind person who just wanted to share what they were excited about with us.
But it was a learning lesson.
It was. I mean, what did I learn from it? Be careful before you put something in your mouth, even though it's called honey.
And if you have constructive criticism, share it.
That is a great learning lesson that I'm still, I mean, sometimes people don't ask for constructive criticism. And I feel like if I offer it without being asked, I'm actually doing them a disservice because they're on their journey, right? They're out there sharing their thing with the world.
Yeah.
And if they didn't ask for feedback and I tell them like, hey, your stuff burned my mouth and I don't, you know, think you should be sharing it with anyone anymore, that might stop them from like, you know, keeping bees or producing honey and like happening that
maybe a small percent, but I mean, your kids don't ask for feedback and you still give it to them, right?
That's part of our social contract, right? Like they're going to live in my house. They're going to hear my thoughts.
I don't know. I think I'm just of the thought that at least a little bit of feedback, not like career ending, don't ever sell us again feedback.
But right. Yeah, yeah.
Just like some like, I didn't enjoy this, it's not for me, here's why.
Nice
kind of feedback.
That's a really well or potentially beneficial way to frame something. Is this from your experience in Coffee Days?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like say you had a roaster who was super enthusiastic, who showed up with some coffee and was like, I want you to cup this, and then you do it and it's like tastes like burning. Mm-hmm. How do you talk to them about it?
To the similar thing I probably just said, just I frame it as like, hey, I tasted your coffee. It's really not my cup of like coffee. I don't necessarily like the flavor. I don't like this, this, and this about it. I do realize though I'm one person and there's probably a market for this somewhere. I just don't personally enjoy it. And this is how I would change it if you're interested.
Or
is probably how I know how best to like give that type of feedback.
And did you have experiences where coffee suppliers came back to you having taken that feedback on board?
Roasted, no, green, yes.
Cool.
And there's a differentiation there in that like most of the time if like someone brings you a roasted and you tell them they're not interested, they like
go find someone else.
Yeah, it's like, okay, they don't don't want to work with you essentially. But with green, the feedback is more like a growth feedback, and that like,
good try.
Well, here's what I'm tasting, and like, here's what I think you can improve, or here's what I would like to see improved. I don't know as much about farming as you probably do, but if you can make it more acidic or cleaner or get rid of this dirty flavor, I would be more, I'd be willing to pay a higher price or buy it or something like that.
Yeah. Which I think is very relevant for us in the mead and honey world. Is like, how do we articulate? Because turns out mead making is super complicated, and you can't just take any old honey and throw it into the fermenter with any old yeast and like come up with a good mead, right? Like, you've got to have these certain precursors in the honey and the right combo of yeast and the right conditions and fermentation process to have a shot at making a good mead.
Yeah.
So we as mead makers have an opportunity and to an extent a responsibility, if we're trying to change and improve the beekeeping industry for the benefit of beekeepers and bees and ecosystems, to communicate to those beekeepers what good honey for mead making is and how it's produced. And, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges for developing countries' honey is smokiness, right? Like, there have been a number of awesome honeys that just are too smoky. And I love the story of where the honey comes from, and I love the, you know, the mission of the organization that brought the honey to me, the honey at the end of the day just has this intense smokiness that I'm pretty sure will persist into the mead. And like, unless we're going to age it for 18 years on oak, like they would a whiskey, which we don't have a business model to do, you know, like,
is there like a commonality of like why smokiness exists in all those honeys?
So
is it different per region?
Yeah. My understanding is that when you use a really intense smelling fuel for the honey, so like in Africa, they apparently use like this mesquite type wood that is very, and Africa is a huge place. So like, it's not even fair for me to just say Africa is three times the size of the United States.
Some places in Africa,
some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, like Kenya and Uganda, use this smoker fuel that is apparently very intense. And then their bees are pretty intense too. So the beekeepers have to use a fair amount of smoke to like pacify them.
Gotcha.
So then by the time that, and it's relatively humid, so probably a lot of the cells are not capped, because the bees won't cap the honey until the cells, the honey within gets down to a certain moisture content.
Okay.
To make sure that that honey is going to be preserved.
Okay.
Naturally, right? Because they have to be like under 22%, might even be under 18% water content to ensure that there's not going to be a spontaneous fermentation. And the bees know what that level is. And if it hasn't reached that level, they won't put a layer of wax over the top and therefore like
seal it off.
Yeah. And then allow it to ferment. So imagine these open cells of mostly created honey now getting a ton of really heavy smoke. They're going to absorb that flavor.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So like, these honeys could be awesome, but then that intense smoky mesquite creosote kind of character comes in and it's like, oh, I don't think this is going to go away when we ferment it. So we would spend all this money on your honey, and then we'd have a product at the end of the day that's like kind of hard to swallow.
Which is a bummer.
Which is not good for business.
That's true.
You know.
Okay. So moving on to, I think we're going to call them hype honeys.
Hype honeys, yes.
Which are honeys that have a good marketing platform, but may not taste good, or maybe they do taste good, but do you know of any, have you tried any, what stick out to you when it comes to like some hype honeys in the industry that you've tried?
So there's definitely Manuka honey, and then there's the Middle Eastern cedar honey. So Manuka is pretty cool because the New Zealand government realized that this story about this honey that had all these curative properties, maybe there was something to it, and they put like tens of millions of dollars behind this research program
Oh, wow.
to identify what made effective Manuka honey effective, and then one made Manuka honey that wasn't effective, not effective. What was missing? So I think they call it like M factor, but there's some measurable compound that is present in authentic Manuka honey to different degrees.
Does it come from a certain plant?
Yeah, it's the Manuka like eucalyptus bush. And so the beekeepers can, I've heard that like a family beekeeping operation is like 100 hives, and that's enough for a family to like live off of.
Wow.
From the revenue from the honey sales from those 100 hives of real Manuka honey.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Super cool. But like you look at the retail price and you're looking at like $40 to $120 a jar. And
how much is in a jar?
Like a pound or less.
Okay.
Like 8 ounces to 16 ounces, depending on that M factor or N factor. Sorry, I'm not a Manuka nerd, but I know that it's a cool,
how dare you.
A cool example of what's possible if the understanding is complete of what makes honey healthy.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so flavor wise, like it's good. It's, a bit menthol-y. It's a bit eucalyptus-y.
Mm-hmm.
But it's edible, totally edible and enjoyable.
It's clean.
It's clean. If I were to make a mead out of it, it would probably end up tasting like a eucalyptus tea.
Yeah.
You know, which I don't think there's as ready a market for, though it could be. You know, there's some Sauvignon Blanc drinkers who really like the eucalyptus aspect. And like, mm-hmm. apparently if you plant Sauvignon Blanc grapevines near eucalyptus, it can like really absorb the eucalyptus terroir, which is wild.
There might be a niche group to buy it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like if you're looking for it and you're open to it, then it might be interesting. But if it just sneaks up on you, it's like, whoa. Yeah. Why am I drinking this medicinal thing that smells like tea tree oil?
Okay. What about the cedar? What's that story?
Okay. So that story is that like Bedouin tribal people who are like still nomads.
Okay.
Like kept bees on their like nomad circuit.
Okay.
And they would like leave them in these cedar groves, which cedars apparently have a lot of magical, mystical properties of, I don't even know, but to these cultures, especially as these cedar groves have reduced over time,
mm-hmm.
and like this honey was something that was probably pretty special to families. Like you get it at special times of the year, and it would be like the celebratory thing. And as the quantity available has reduced over time, the demand for it has driven the prices up.
Gotcha.
So there's like a fair amount of hype around this, but apparently there are similar, at least anecdotal evidence, I'm not sure about the actual research of the health benefits of this kind of honey, but within these cultures, they're like cedar honey is untouchable. It's incredible. Oh, there's also the mad honey. Have you heard about that?
No, what's the mad honey?
Oh, man. Rhododendron honey?
You have to explain that.
I think that one will kill you, actually.
What?
Yeah, rhododendron honey. So apparently, all right, is it Himalayan mad honey? So too much of it, I guess, can kill you, but a small amount can make you like drunk and hallucinating.
Sounds like your hornet honey.
Well, the hornet honey was euphoric. It was kind of like being stung, but you ate it.
Okay.
Whereas I haven't ever tried this rhododendron stuff, but apparently there's a Joe Rogan episode on it.
Oh, okay.
And
so like, is it made specially, or is it collected from a special plant?
So I guess there's Asian rhododendron honey, which is made by the big bees, the Apis serrani, which is a social bee that lives on the cliff walls in Asia, and it's kind of famous in like Nepal and Tibet, I think.
Okay.
And northeast India. And then there's apparently European rhododendron honey, and I think that one's more toxic and more likely to kill people. And there's apparently a story of some general that left out pots of it because his army wasn't going to beat this other army, and then the other army ate it, and then they all got drunk and some of them died, and then the army that was retreating that left the honey out went back and killed them all. They were all falling over themselves having eaten this honey. I think it was like Hannibal or something, this famous general. Anyways, though, yes, I have not tried that honey, but there's a good story behind it apparently.
It's a military tactic I haven't heard of. Right? About the honey.
Leave out the poison honey.
That's pretty cool. Okay. Is there any honey you're excited to try or you want to try the road?
I mean, it's like every week we get like a new honey that's like, oh, can we make that into mead? So we're buying this honey from Mexico right now that came to us under the orange blossom, like an organic orange blossom umbrella. And we're just going to get a 60-pound pail of it and see if we can make something good. But instead of the typical citrus core note of like citrus candy and lemon verbena and jasmine, It has a little bit of that citrus candy, and then it goes like full on white flower, like geranium and plumeria.
Gotcha.
Like the synthesis of those. So it's super floral. I think we're going to use our really floral fermenting white wine yeast just to accentuate that. Their acidity is going to be a bit of a challenge with it because I think it's pretty low in total acidity as a honey. So we'll just see what the final acidity is, and we might have to do a little bit of adjustment, which isn't what we usually do, but since we're in the innovation phase here, we can play with it to just see if that's how we achieve balance, and then maybe find a yeast that produces more acidity in white fermentations. That's white fair. Floral fermentations, yeah. So that one I'm excited about. So we'll call that Mexican almost orange blossom, but
almost orange blossom.
Mexican white flower blossom. Then, I mean, the thyme and the heather, if we can get our hands on that and ferment with that, I think that would be awesome. I'm really also passionate about ecosystem honeys, right? If a beekeeper has left their bees in a ecosystem for the right amount of time and harvested the right amount of honey, then hopefully that's a sustainable system, right? The bees can stay there. They help the system thrive by increasing its reproduction. And that's not necessarily a static thing. Just by the bees being there, they're going to kind of change the ecosystem to represent more of the things that thrive with the bees' reproduction, which is something that I've only thought of right now. But pollination ecologists, like, that's what they get masters and PhDs in. And I'm talking to more and more of them these days. But to find honeys that represent ecosystems, that have a flavor profile that is outside of the vegetal medicinal, I like to avoid vegetal medicinal honeys. So for people out there listening to this, like, what does that mean? That means that when you taste it, after the sweetness goes away, what is the aroma that comes into your mouth that is the result of all of the flavor molecule chemicals beyond the sweetness volatilizing, becoming a gas, going into your nasal cavity, touching your brain? If those aromas are vegetal or medicinal or, you know, dirty or chemical, like, we don't want to deal with those honeys. There may be a market for that, but we want to stick on the floral, fruity, confectionery, caramel, toffee, molasses end of the honey spectrum. And if that is like the result of an ecosystem,
even better.
If that is the result of an ecosystem, even better. Yeah.
Like, that's optimal for Golden Coast meat standard right there.
Yeah, because you're telling someone, hey, drink this. This comes from this place. And when you drink this drink, you're actually drinking this place. This place is becoming a part of you. And if you like this drink, you're saying you like that place, which is, I think, important to connect people with places and like the actual physical real world.
Yeah, I agree. We're too disconnected from what we consume nowadays.
There's a lot of benefit to be had when we connect with the place that produces what we consume.
Very true. And we'd love to hear about any honeys you guys are interested in or you guys love. Feel free to email us some or
send us a voice memo to podcast@goldencoastmead.com.
Yeah.
And we'll include it in an episode. Yeah. You know, something like, hey, this is your first name here from the city and state or country that you're from. And you love this honey because ... And, you know, give us a 30 to 60 second explanation of the honey and we'll include it in an episode.
Yeah. We'd love to hear. Yeah. We'd love to hear about all kinds of honeys and taste honeys and do anything with honey.
Amen.
All right. That's a wrap on Frank's journey with honey. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. We appreciate all the support we can get. If there's anything you'd like to know more about, feel free to email us at podcast@goldencoastmead.com with your questions, and we'll answer them to the best of our ability for you. Now, here's your weekly bee joke. What does a bee use to style its hair? A honeycomb. Mead out.